nobody without trying could write a treatise on social action in the church, and they asked me to come and speak about social action. And I felt very humbled to be here to talk to you about that. Today's subject, I think, is one that we have a huge amount of distance to travel with. Certainly in the historic churches, but pretty likely too in the independent churches, and I'm glad that looking around the room, there's a very broad representation here from a whole different set of churches, and hopefully together we can produce some energy and some synergy that will provoke some debate after I've spoken to you. I was just this weekend, I was talking to somebody. I got my bus pass a week ago, and so I was traveling on a bus, and which has not been a common experience for me in the past. And there was a conversation going on in the bus, which I was, you know, judging a little harshly. It's pretty trivial. It was all about, you know, blooming stagecoach and withdrawing the X27 service, which I don't really understand, but I gather it's another bus service. So I thought I would try and solve the conversation a little bit with this bunch of older ladies. So I said to them, "Tell me, what's become clearer to you in the last few months?" And they're like, "What?" I said, "Well, you know, what's become clearer? You know, what, you know, here you are, you're doing your lives. What are you learning about?" So this lady said, "I'm learning that the health service sucks." Another lady said, "I'm learning that the government doesn't care about its senior citizens." An older man who said, "I'm learning that putting my money in the bank and trying to save was a wasted venture." And then they said, you know, that question that people like me hate to be asked when we're traveling in Mufti. And I was in a slightly compromised situation, as I'd just been at the eye hospital, and they put these drops in my eyes that made everybody look blurry. And this person said to me, "What do you do for a living?" And so, you know, it crossed my mind, should I say something like, "I'm in middle management in a large national organization?" If I said that, would I hear a cock crow in my head or something like that? So I told them what I did. They're like, "What? You're the bishop?" "Yeah, I'm the..." "Yeah." "You know, yeah." They're like, "Wait, so why are you on the bus?" I said, "Because I'm 60, you know, and it's kind of novel to have a bus pass and get on for free and meet curious people like yourselves." They said, "Oh, yeah, two forums," said stuff like, "I used to go to church." And I said, "So what stopped you?" And this woman, without any hesitation, said, she said, "Because it's shocking." I said, "Really?" You know, can you give me the name and address of the church you responded to? "This is what I have responsibility for." I didn't say that. So she said, "It's all about them and us. It's all about a bunch of people out there that wear dog collars and tell us what to do." And I thought to myself, you know, I always try and spend a lot of my life speaking to people who don't know Christ. And maybe don't have too much of a predilection to know. But what's interesting to me is everybody, no matter how godless they are, no matter what kind of a disordered life they're living, has an opinion about the church. I discovered that when I was a young assistant minister and what we call a curate in my setup. And I mean, it's a really weird thing. You know, you get ordained, there's a big service in the cathedral, and you know, all that kind of weird stuff that goes on. And then, you know, you kind of, Monday morning, you're like, "Now what?" You know, what do you do? I mean, the vicar said, you know, he gave me a few people. I think I didn't know this. The vicar's plan was, I'll send him to visit all the people I've upset in the last 4 days. blessed people. So I used to go cold door knocking. I couldn't think of anything else to do, to be honest with you. I used to spend my mornings reading and praying, and then in the afternoon, I would go and knock on doors and introduce myself and see what happened next. And what was clear then, and is even clearer to me now, is that an awful lot of what people describe as atheism in our culture isn't atheism at all. It's nothing to do with God. It's a rejection of church. And you remember that Alistair McGrath wrote this excellent book, if you've not read it, please read it, called The Twilight of Atheism, where he argued very coherently that Western atheism is very little to do with belief theism, to be, in other words, in relation to belief in God or not belief in God. It is the rejection of the authority of the church, which of course in Europe meant the Roman Catholic Church and its interventionist kind of rather over-authoritarian approach. I don't think that, you know, it's becoming to sit back and just blame Roman Catholicism for that, because I think all of those who have responsibility for churches have to put our hands up and say, have we run churches which is about them and us? And there are two kind of groups of them and us. There's firstly what the old lady was on about, and that is the people who run churches and the rest. And then there is the issue of those of us who are in churches and those who aren't. The us and them of that. And it struck me that, you know, when John was doing this little preamble there, that he rightly stressed it's good for Christians to get together and talk together about their stuff and what they're doing. Actually, the meetings that really excited me when I was in local church ministry were the meetings where the Christians were there, but there were other interdisciplinary representatives there as well. So we had doctors and social workers and people like that. That gave us two opportunities. Firstly, to learn a little bit from them as to the way their world was taking shape and the way they were thinking. The second thing was, it allowed us to try and communicate to them that we are interested in the whole business of people's lives. That we believe in a God, I do, I think you do. We believe in a God who the Bible says loves the world. Clearly he loves the church, though sometimes you wonder why. But he certainly loves the world, and he calls us as people to reflect that love for the world by the way that we are. And the reason why I'm very glad to talk about this subject to you is that I believe that the churches, we're not wrong and we're not bad at all. I mean, there are some churches where, you know, probably wouldn't encourage anybody to go, at least not with a sharp object anywhere near them. I think a lot of the time, you know, what strikes me about church is the missed opportunity that comes from creating agendas which are primarily internal and to do with things that nobody else on planet Earth is vaguely interested in. I can only say for my own, I'm sure upset anybody who's saying this, but I can only say in my own church at the moment, I mean, we seem to be making a complete fool of ourselves by arguing whether women or not are suitable to take, you know, senior responsibility in the church. You know, when you kind of wash that kind of washing out in public, it's little wonder that people find you trivial and largely irrelevant. So, what do we mean by releasing the energy of the whole people of God? Well, I made this observation some years ago, and that is the kind of subsuming characteristic of ecclesiastical culture. That is to say, I observed very clearly that the more people became committed to Christ, the more they seemed to become committed to their church, and the less committed they seemed to become to the world around them. So then, when I was in local church ministry and I arrived in my first senior pastorate as a vicar, I went to a church which was very middle of the road, had some evangelicals who kind of gritted their teeth and sort of sat on the pews thinking about England, who came to me and said, you're the answer to all our problems. And what became clear very quickly was I was the beginning of their problems. And when we used to talk about witness and stuff like that, the thing that used to really amaze me about these people who were really committed to our churches, they would say, well, we don't have any non-Christian friends. Our whole of our lives is centered around your church. And so I think one of the things that has struck me is that when we talk about church, we tend to think about a bunch of people gathering in some neo-Gothic structure with a kind of agenda. You know, obviously worship is very important to what we do, and so not saying that we shouldn't do that. But the great mistake is that we seem to become less and less connected to the world, with the added observation that the kind of churches that are really lively, what they do is they up the level of Christian activity, which means that their members get less and less connected to the world in which they find themselves. So we're exhausting people, you know, running the Christian basketball organization or the Christian women's association, all that stuff. And I believe if we're ever going to release the energy of the people of God, what we have to do is to give to our people the confidence as Christians to go and join the basketball club, not the Christian basketball club, to go and join the Wives Fellowship, not the Christian Wives Fellowship, and to get stuck into the world which God loves. And that would be hugely uncomplicated if it wasn't for people like me, or David. Because when you're running a church, of course you want to kind of make the thing work as well as you can. And it's not that, you know, any of us who are ordained or in spiritual leadership, I think, are blinkered necessarily about that world out there. It's just that there is huge pressure, some of it financial, some of it cultural, some of it internal and demanding. That means that we can start to build churches that do exactly the opposite of what we claim we would like them to do. You know, I hear ministers standing up in their pulpits on a Sunday preaching great messages about the Great Commission, you know, and they're saying, we've got to reverse the dynamic in our churches, you know, let's stop all this come stuff and let's get it into go stuff. And then you get to the notices, and you begin to realize why people have got no energy and no time left to go anywhere, because every night there's something going on in the life of their church. And then I came across in our churches this thing that I think is very seductive for us. It's deep in our culture, as a matter of fact. Now, those of your parents, particularly those of your parents who've had kids go through stuff like GCSEs, you know, most kids have to take 8, 9, you know, if they're superbly bright, you know, 10, 11 GCSEs. Now, as a parent, you know, what interests me is we might have kids who are excellent in 6 out of 8 subjects. What are the subjects we focus on? We focus on the 2 that they're not very good at, so that we hopefully can get this deep in our culture to minister to people's weakness rather than to minister to people's strength. And there's a very good book you can read by a guy called Marcus Buckingham. He's not a believer, but his stuff is based on a huge amount of worldwide research. I think the book is called Playing to Your Strengths. And I would recommend that, because I think this man, who I suspect doesn't know an awful lot of the Bible, has a very biblical view of human development. And I'll talk to you about that in just a minute. But I mean, the same in our denomination, you know, the Church of England, when we do ministerial reviews. It's tempting to say, here's a dear minister who is a holy man of God, who says his prayers, who leads divine worship sensitively, who visits his people and prays for them and does all the stuff that you kind of classic Church of England minister is meant to do. But he never answers a letter. And his administration, frankly, you know, if you go in his study, it looks like an atomic weapon went off. So you do your ministerial review. What does it come up with? We need to send this person on an administrative course to get them better at administration. Wrong. Play to people's strengths. Now, it's a long way from Marcus Buckingham in one way to the pneumatology of St. Paul as given exposition in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12. But it's a journey that's well worth making. What does St. Paul say about it? St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 7, manifestation of the Spirit is given to all. And then Paul unpacks what he means by that. What he means is that every Christian, accord with your own theological predilection, whether you want to say every baptized Christian or every born-again Christian, whatever. And that every Christian is given spiritual gifts by God. And you know, woe betide churches, in a way, that don't understand this. And the reason why, you know, clericalism just has to kind of be a little careful here is that I have discovered after years of working with church leaders that some church leaders are threatened by the giftedness of their members in such a way that they will suppress that giftedness. No, it's a bit like the business of, my recruitment strategy, insofar as I'm able to operate it within the Church of England, has always been appoint people who are better than me. You know, why wouldn't I do that? Well, the answer is, I'm not threatened by people who are smart. I like being with people who are smart and can do a much better job than I can. But I have learned that there are lots of people in church leadership today. They're exactly the opposite. Somebody starts to excel in an area of giftedness and they're learning to cover and putting the brakes on the development of that person. And, if we kind of think that ministry is fundamentally about control, I'll talk about accountability in a little while, but if we think it's fundamentally about controlling people, I think we're missing that kind of energy of the Holy Spirit, which is, it's not a vortex, it's a centrifuge. It's always pushing energy outwards. That's why the missionary dynamic of the church is missionary. It's about being sent into the world. But what does Paul teach us in 1 Corinthians chapter 12? Well, first of all, very important, don't forget this. You know it, but let me remind you. Every baptized / born again Christian is given gifts from God. Now, I am immensely grateful for the impact of renewal on the churches. I was caught up with that in the early 70s. I went off it for 20 years because I didn't think it really enriched the mission of the church. I'm now back on it big time because I see a spiritual energy there that I don't see anywhere else. One of the things that I'm eternally grateful to the charismatic movement, as we used to call it, for was this emphasis on every member ministry. One of the things I'm less grateful for was the idea that somehow the gifts of the Spirit were all the kind of spooky ones. So, you know, it was about the gift of tongues or the gift of discernment, you know, that if you go to a church, and it sounds like I'm deriding this, I'm really not deriding it, but, you know, the fascination with, you go to a church, somebody stand up and say there's somebody with an issue in their left nostril, you know, they come forward for prayer and all this kind of stuff, right? Now, I believe there is a gift of discernment. I certainly believe there's a gift of speaking in tongues. I certainly believe there's a gift of prophecy. I don't need persuading that the kind of more spooky gifts, are in you know, I believe they're as valid as the other gifts, but focusing on them, frankly, scared a generation of clergy and a damn generation of lay people off really exploring what their giftedness was. I mean, let me remind you that Paul, in the ardor of talking about prophecy and tongues and discernment, also talked about administration. I was at a leadership symposium led by this very eminent sociologist last week, who'd been interviewing my colleagues, bishops in the Church of England, about leadership. You know what they said? A lot of my fellow colleagues said, leadership is not a theological term. Hello? 1 Corinthians 12:8, if your gift is leadership, lead with diligence, St. Paul says. So, every Christian believer is given gifts. And when I'm talking about releasing the energy of the whole of God's people, it is releasing people to exercise their spiritual giftedness. And believe me, friends, if you want to see the people who you have responsibility grow, whether you're working in a kind of ecclesial environment or whether you're working out there in the big bad world, the naughty world, as the Catechism of the Church of England puts it, a lot of frustration is felt by a lot of people in our churches because they don't know what their gifts are. Or they know what their gifts are and nobody will release them to exercise those gifts. Why does God give us gifts? Well, Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 4, nobody says Jesus is Lord apart from the Spirit of God. See, spiritual giftedness is not given to me to draw attention to myself. If ever I would be over-tempted to draw attention to myself, God has given me a wife who is keen to offer corrective therapy at every conceivable moment. I sometimes sit enviously through conversations with fellow clergy and their spouses, and their spouses say, of course, it's very difficult when somebody criticizes my spouse. I hadn't noticed it that much with my wife because when people start jumping rocks at me, she's able to pick up a boulder and swing it liberally in my direction. And spiritual gifts are not about how can I draw attention to myself. They're about how can I glorify God. And the problem is the way we human beings are wired up, unfortunately, most of us have a fairly long and ensuing battle with our own ego. I sometimes think to myself, when Paul said in Philippians, always think of other people as better than yourselves. Quite how that plays off with the kind of tidal wave of 20th century psychology that the church has been subject to. It's not that I take an extreme view of 20th century psychology, don't get me wrong. It's just that I cannot see, in a world where most people feel that the basic human condition is not sinfulness but low self-esteem, that actually Paul's advice that we should think of others as better than ourselves and then play out and that comfortably. So this is not about you and me. You know, as the chorus worship song, whatever you call it, goes, it's all about you, Jesus. It's not about Mike Hill or any of us. It's about how can my life point others to God through the exercise of my giftedness. I think that's a particular challenge for those of us who have preaching gifts, those of us who have creative art gifts. Because in a sense, how can you not draw attention to yourself when you're standing up in front of people and they're listening to you? I think the answer is to try and be as honest as you can about the struggles that you have. Though let me say that the kind of preacher who gets in the pulpit and says, I'm a loser, you're a bunch of losers, so let's lose together, really doesn't do the Lord on that much. See, Paul's view of human development is this, that we will develop best when we know what our firstly, to glorify God. Secondly, and these are not in ascending order of priority after the first one. Glorifying God is critical. The second one is edifying the church. We need people in church who exercise their gifts for the effective and faithful ministry of the church being maintained. But the third thing is, we need gifts to serve the world. And I don't need to persuade BCAN lunchtime meeting people that there's a case to be made here. I think sometimes I need to persuade some of my church leader colleagues that actually the impact and influence of their churches would be turbocharged massively if they would be happy to let some of the people in their churches go out into the world and exercise their giftedness there. You know, I love it when, I've seen it a couple of times in my life and in my own ministry, because I'm a person who jets to people on airplanes and trains and all that stuff, you know. I can take you today to two CEOs of major international companies who've become Christ on the back of a chance conversation on a plane or on a train. Now, you could say, so what's the evidence that they have transformed lives? And you could say, well, they go to church. Actually, one of them, I think, struggles a bit with what goes on in this church. But he goes there. The bulk of his ministry, he sees, is trying to work out what does it mean to be a CEO and a Christian. And he finds the church a surprisingly poverty-stricken place to get any support in trying to work out how we can get better at that. And one of the challenges, you know, everywhere I go, you know, people identify the challenge well. I don't know anybody who's entirely cracked it. How do you network people together in such a way that they self-help each other to get better at being a Christian in the discipline that they have? I remember some years ago, and I love this story, that in Shell Chemicals, as it was then, there were three or four Christian people who became aware that the kind of exploration aspect of Shell petrol was starting to act very unethically in certain parts of the world, where they were going, drilling, creating all kinds of mess, polluting rivers, etc., etc., and then just leaving. And these Christians, who didn't really know each other in the organization, through a casual meeting, two of them met together and discovered that they were both concerned about this. So they put a notice on the notice board, and, you know, you might say it's a dim thing to do in one way, saying, you know, if any Christians in the organization, we're going to meet together on Wednesday lunchtimes, and about six or eight of them showed up. And it turned out all eight of them were feeling distinctly unhappy about what happened in the organization. And then the head of exploration showed up at the meeting. And they were able to have this interaction with the head of exploration, who was probably a churchgoer, and put before them their concerns. And they discussed it, and they prayed together about it, and the group became a kind of a bit like a sort of Franciscan cell or something, because they used to meet together, and one of their numbers was a non-stipendiary minister working in the petrochemicals. So they'd have a little communion service together at lunchtime, they had lunch discussion, prayer together. Became a very powerful, even influential group within a very large organization. And I apply a lot of my mind to working out how can we as a church have more influence on public policy and on ethics in the workplace. And sometimes I think we suffer from feeling ourselves to be a kind of minority. So I think sometimes we're a bit too cozy, too keen to cozy up to secular authorities who are doing things, because we're looking for recognition rather than for change. Two very different agendas there. If you're looking to get stroked by the local council, that will affect your approach to the you're not going to change the world, then there will be times when you need to stand up and be counted and say something that probably won't get you many brownie points or much favorable press coverage. So these gifts of the Spirit are given to the people of God in order that